We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
Away we go. Episode 96 of the Al Galdi podcast, the Cornelius Griffin episode. It is Tuesday, July 6th, 2021. Hello. Nice to be with you. Back from the July 4th weekend. Back from a week of vacation, with the word vacation in quotation marks. We were in Beaufort, South Carolina, a very nice town, to which we drove. 8-hour drive if you don't stop. We, of course, had to stop. Plus, there was traffic. Plus, we had to wait for a bridge to open up and then close again. So we're talking more like a 10-hour drive. You have not lived until while operating on 3 hours of sleep and trying to nap in the passenger seat, you have been repeatedly kicked from behind by your 3-year-old son, causing your neck to keep snapping. I'm going to sue him for CTE. I promise you that's coming. But anyway, we have a lot to do, a lot to discuss on the show, as we are now just 3 weeks away from the start of Washington football team training camp. That's it. 3 weeks, my friends. Tuesday, July 27th. That is day number one of WFT training camp in 2021. I am with you the rest of this week. I will be doing another vacation week next week. But again, vacation is in quotation marks. I'll still be doing 3 shows next week. Gotta get in the vacation days before training camp begins. But you gotta do vacation while still doing some shows, because you never know what may happen. Just like last Thursday, we had the outcome of the Beth Wilkinson investigation. And speaking of that, I have some more thoughts for you coming up, as well as thoughts on something else that happened last Thursday regarding Dan Snyder. What was yet another win for the Danny, who these days is doing nothing but winning. Dan Snyder, I promise you, is laughing at all of us right now. All of the turmoil of the last year, all of the criticism, you know, all of the talking heads yelling and screaming, all of the columnists writing and opining, none of it matters. The Danny keeps winning. However, our Washington football team talk, on this installment of the Al Galdi podcast will not just be limited to the Snyder stuff. We will be talking some actual football, if that's okay with everyone. If we talk about football when it comes to the Washington football team, special guest for you, Ben Lindsay, analyst for Pro Football Focus. He every summer ranks all 32 NFL rosters. His rankings for this summer came out last Thursday. Yes, last Thursday was a busy day. And guess which team shot up the rankings? You got it. The Washington football team, 31st in 2020, 12th in 2021. A 19-spot surge for the WFT when it comes to where the team's roster ranks in the NFL. Also on the show, I will talk Nationals. Next segment, in fact, a gut check win at the San Diego Padres late night on Monday night, 7-5 the final. It was not a good July 4th weekend for the Nats. It was, though, a very good Monday night. There's a lot to unpack with the Nationals. We'll get to doing that next segment. I will talk Wizards, as we on Monday had a major update on their head coaching search. I will talk Maryland basketball, as we on Monday evening had major news, and it wasn't good news, at least not for the Terrapins, as Aaron Wiggins is staying in the NBA draft. And I will talk Orioles, who got worked, got plowed, got humbled by Shohei Ohtani over the July 4th weekend.
Make him humble!
Yes, the Iron Sheik, a.k.a. Sheiky Baby. Make him humble.
Make him humble.
Thank you. A reminder to please subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. Costs you nothing. Means everything. And especially if you're listening to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, please give the podcast a 5-star rating and just write like a 1-sentence review saying how much you like the podcast. Those things help out a lot in terms of this podcast ranking well and ultimately doing well. So I appreciate your help with these things. You can tweet me at Al Galdi. You can email me, the Al Galdi podcast at yahoo.com. I, on Friday's show, talked about July 4th weekend being the one-year anniversary of the weekend that changed everything regarding the name of the team that now is the Washington football team. July 4th weekend 2020 was when the name change saga truly was ignited last year. Email from Cap Skins fan. I liked your segment on the Redskins name change, but couldn't disagree with you more about continuing to be a fan of the Redskins when the name was changed. And I was a season ticket holder since FedEx Field, then Jack Kent Cook Stadium, opened. I wouldn't give them a penny now. No how, no way. I don't even watch the games on TV any longer. Some of us were Redskins fans much more than general football fans. We cared about the team's games and those that affected the team, like games of division rivals. Now that our team is gone, there is no interest. We were Redskins fans. I think there are a lot more of us out here than local media wants to admit. Well, I don't doubt that there are people like you, Capskins fan, and I respect where you're coming from. I do. There's no right way to handle the name change, okay? Like, I think reasonable people can disagree on whether the name should have ever changed. I also think reasonable people can react to the name change in a variety of ways. I don't think there's like one right way to have reacted to the name change. And at the end of the day, you can't help how you feel. And if the name changing has affected your fandom that much, I respect where you're coming from. As I said in the segment on Friday's show, there's a lot about this whole name saga that still does not sit right with me. But I don't think that there are enough people like you to cause a severe decline in the fan base of the team if it becomes good again. And that's the key to this whole thing. If the team becomes good again. If the team continues to be a perennial loser with countless off-the-field problems, then yes, the fan base will continue to decline no matter what the name is. But if the team starts winning, then any notion of a declining fan base, I believe, will disappear if for no other reason then the team winning will create new and younger fans who offset the fans who checked out due to the name change. Winning is the thing. Winning is everything. If the team wins, the fan base will be strong. If the team keeps losing, as the team has largely been losing for the last quarter plus century, then the fan base is going to continue to decline. That is the task for Ron Rivera. Win. Just win. Winning will make the name change much more palatable. Well, as you know, Ron Rivera last year dealt with something very serious, skin cancer. He thankfully appears to be doing quite well right now. Skin cancer just happens to be an area of expertise for Dr. George Verghese. He is the medical director for the Mid-Atlantic Skin Surgery Institute of Maryland. He is a board-certified dermatologist and Mohs surgeon. The Mid-Atlantic Skin Surgery Institute of Maryland diagnoses and treats a broad range of acute and chronic skin conditions, including skin cancer. And if you or someone you know is dealing with skin cancer, first of all, we wish you or the someone you know nothing but the best. Second of all, Dr. George Verghese and his institute offer something that's a game changer: superficial radiation therapy, or SRT. SRT is an alternative to surgical procedures for basal cell and squamous cell skin cancers. SRT is safe, effective, and non-surgical. You see, having skin cancer doesn't mean having to have surgery and the downtime and side effects, cosmetic and otherwise, that come with surgery. You have options. SRT is an option, and Dr. George Verghese and the Mid-Atlantic Skin Surgery Institute of Maryland offer the option of SRT, unlike many other dermatology practices in the area, and SRT is covered by most insurances. To find out more, call 301-396-3401. Make sure you tell them that Al Galdi sent you. That phone number again, 301-396-3401, or visit midatlanticskin.com. That's midatlanticskin.com. Dr. George Verghese in the Mid-Atlantic Skin Surgery Institute of Maryland, nationally recognized for treating skin cancer across the Mid-Atlantic region. All right, before we get to the Washington football team, let us talk some Nationals who have had a wild last few days. The Nats, Thursday night through Sunday, got swept in a four-game series against the Los Angeles Dodgers at Nationals Park. But the Nats on Monday night, late night, won at the San Diego Padres 7-5 in Game 1 of a four-game series. The Nats are in the midst of a brutal stretch leading into the All-Star break. And the Nats right now seemingly are contending in the National League West. Four games against the Dodgers at Nats Park, followed by a seven-game road trip that consists of four games at the Padres and then three games at the San Francisco Giants. The Dodgers, Padres, and Giants are not just the three best teams in the National League West. The Dodgers, Padres, and Giants are the teams with, by far, the three best run differentials in the National League. This is a gauntlet that the Nats are in the midst of, but the Nats came through on Monday night. And so, Davey Martinez, if you would.
I'm proud of the boys.
Yes, Davey, and you should be. Nats now are 41-42, second in the National League East, four games behind the division-leading New York Mets, half game ahead of both the Atlanta Braves and Philadelphia Phillies. The Mets on Monday beat the Milwaukee Brewers 4-2. The Braves on Monday night lost at the Pittsburgh Pirates 11-1. The Phillies on Monday night won at the Chicago Cubs 13-3. So let's start with this. The Nats have been an injury-ravaged mess over the last few days. No injury bigger than the Kyle Schwarber injury. The Nats on Saturday put left fielder Kyle Schwarber on the 10-day injured list with a right hamstring strain that appears to be quite severe. Now, the good news is that the injury does not require surgery, but Schwarber on Saturday called the injury, quote, a pretty decent injury, end quote. I don't think we're seeing Schwarber back until at least August. Schwarber suffered the injury in the 10-5 loss to the Dodgers at Nationals Park on Friday night. He had a two-out single to right center field in the bottom of the second, but he, in running to first base, hurt the right hamstring, ended up leaving the game. And this was so painful, both literally and figuratively, because it was just a few hours before all of this that Schwarber was named National League Player of the Month for June, right? I mean, Kyle Schwarber in June had the month to end all months. He, in June, over 27 games, hit 16 home runs, had a slugging percentage of 760, had an OPS of 1,122, and had 30 runs batted in. So Schwarber has a month that we'll never forget, And then, like, right after that, he suffers this right hamstring strain that likely is going to keep him out for, I don't know, anywhere from, like, 3 to 6 weeks, I would say. You know, and that's just a guess, but this does not sound like one of these injuries from which he'll be back in just a few weeks here. He's on the 10-day injured list. He's going to be on that list for a lot more than 10 days. I can promise you that. But it's not just the Schwarber injury. The Nats on Saturday put their backup catcher, Alex Avila, on the 10-day injured list, retroactive to July 2nd, with bilateral calf strains. More on that in just a bit. The Nats on Friday put infielder Jordy Mercer on the 10-day injured list, retroactive to July 1st, with a strained right quadriceps. And those guys have joined a number of other guys on the Nats 10-day IL. Outfielder Andrew Stevenson, oblique strain. Starter Steven Strasburg, neck strain. Starter Eric Fetty, left oblique strain. Reliever Daniel Hudson, right elbow inflammation. Reliever Tanner Rainey, stress reaction in his right tibia. Reliever Kyle Finnegan, left hamstring strain. Reliever Will Harris, right hand inflammation. You get the idea. The Nats are banged up big time right now. Now, the Nats did get some good injury news for the start of this series at the Padres. Trey Turner was back. So Turner missed all four games of the Nats' four-game sweep to the Dodgers at Nationals Park due to having jammed his left middle finger, sliding into third base on his triple that gave him his third career cycle in that 15-6 win over the Tampa Bay Rays at Nationals Park last Wednesday on what was Trey's 28th birthday. Well, Turner was back out there on Monday night. It was great to see this. Starting shortstop, number two batter, and man, did he hit the ground running. 2 for 4 with a homer, a single, and a walk. And how about the homer? Turner with a one-out first-pitch solo homer on a bomb to left field in the top of the first. So on his very first pitch back, Trey Turner hits a homer and against the team, remember, from which the Nats acquired Trey Turner, right? The Nats made that famous trade, that three-team deal, in which Trey Turner ultimately was a player to be named later from the San Diego Padres. That homer was some shot, though. The home run going a projected 410 feet per Statcast. Turner also had a one-out single to center field that loaded the bases in the Nats' four-run second, and Turner drew a two-out, eight-pitch walk in the top of the eighth, despite having been down in the count at 1.12. And Turner's night was a big part of the Nats scoring 7 runs at the Padres. And don't take that for granted. Scoring at San Diego is not easy to do. Petco Park is a notorious pitcher's park. The Padres are built for that park. They pitch well. They field well. The Padres starting pitcher on Monday night was Joe Musgrove, who's had a very good season, although he was not very good on Monday night. 5 runs in 5 innings. That's a really nice job by the Nats to put up a 7 spot in that game at a team like the San Diego Padres. And it wasn't just Trey Turner who delivered offensively for the Nats on Monday night. Josh Bell, the resurgence of Josh Bell continue. Starting first baseman at number four batter on Monday night, 3 for 5 with a homer, 2 singles, and 2 RBI. Bell had a 2-out first pitch single in the top of the first. He had a 1-out RBI single up the middle in the Nats' 4-run second, and he smashed a 1-out first pitch solo homer to left center field in the top of the seventh on a homer that went a projected 412 feet per Statcast. I said resurgence, and man, is that the case with Josh Bell. He was so bad early this season. I mean, you really can't overstate the extent to which Josh Bell struggled over the first month of this season. But here we are now. Josh Bell has raised his OPS for the season by, get this, 311 points since the start of games on May 1st. So basically, over the last 2 months, a little more than that, Josh Bell has upped his OPS for the season by 311 points, from 464 to 775. He has gone from having a nightmare of a season that makes you question whether he should still be on the ball club to now having a season in which his OPS is approaching 800, which is a nice season, and who knows how much higher that OPS ends up going. Josh Bell right now is confident. Josh Bell on the season has actually done quite well in 2-strike counts. Josh Bell really seems to feast in first pitch scenarios. I mean, just on Monday night, 2-out first pitch single, top of the first. 1-out first pitch solo homer in the top of the seventh. And Josh Bell is coming through. I mean, he has become a major offensive force here for the Nationals over the last few months. It's easy to sort of lose sight of this, but Josh Bell has gone from being a complete disaster to now being one of the Nationals' best hitters this season. And you never thought you'd say a phrase like that, right? Josh Bell, one of the Nats' best hitters this season. And yet that's exactly the case as we speak here on this Tuesday. Also delivering for the Nationals offensively on Monday night. And this is another surprising thing I'm about to say. Alcides Escobar. Just a few days ago, Alcides Escobar had not played in a major league game since 2018. He wasn't on the Nationals just a few days ago. The Nats on Saturday acquired Escobar from the Kansas City Royals for cash considerations. This season is Alcides Escobar's age 34 season. Like I said, he had not played in a major league game since the 2018 season, during which he had a wins above replacement per Baseball Reference, a BWAR, of -2.2. Alcides Escobar in the 2018 season was horrendous. The Nats give up basically nothing to get him on Saturday. He's been a starter for the Nationals over the last three games now, and this guy's hitting. I don't know where this is coming from. Alcides Escobar was the Nats' starting shortstop in games 3 and 4 against the Dodgers. And Alcides Escobar on Monday night was the Nats' starting second baseman and number one batter. Davey Martinez had Alcides Escobar as the Nats' leadoff batter on Monday night. And sure enough, Alcides came through 3 for 4. He had an RBI double, 2 singles, and an RBI sacrifice bunt, although the bunt was a lot more than just a sacrifice. The bunt, a one-out RBI bunt down the first base line on a squeeze play with runners at the corners in the Nats' four-run second inning. A beautifully executed bunt by Alcides. He also had a one-out single in the top of the fourth, despite having been down in the count at 1.02. He had a two-out single in the top of the sixth. He had a two-out RBI ground rule double in the top of the eighth, despite having been down in that count at 1.12. And it wasn't just on Monday night on which Alcides delivered. Alcides Escobar in the 5-1 loss to the Dodgers at Nationals Park on Sunday, 3 for 4 in that game. He had a double and 2 singles. He had a one-out single in the bottom of the fourth, despite having been down at the count at 1.02. He had a two-out full-count double in the bottom of the sixth. He had a leadoff single on an 0-2 pitch in the bottom of the ninth. Alcides Escobar is really good at putting balls in play. He, despite being down in a number of counts, has been able to turn those counts into plate appearances with positive outcomes. And again, given that the guy had not played in the majors since 2018, I mean, this is a jaw-dropper that he's delivered as he has here over, yes, this small sample size of games with the Nats so far. I have mentioned this before, and I think it's one of the really cool things about the Nationals in recent years. Mike Rizzo, the man who I refer to as the ninja, has really developed a penchant for getting guys who are discarded from other teams, getting guys who look shot, and then getting major production from those guys, at least with position players, right? Gerardo Parra, Asdrubal Cabrera, Josh Harrison, and now, you have to say, at least for the moment, Alcides Escobar. He's done a really good job for the Nats over these last few games. I also want to credit Victor Robles, who, off a terrible series against the Dodgers, had a couple of doubles on Monday night. Robles, starting center fielder, number 8 batter, 2 for 4 with 2 doubles on Monday night. He had a one-out full-count double to left field in the Nats' 4-run second, and he had a one-out full-count double in the Nats' 1-run 8th inning. Robles, in that 4-game sweep to the Dodgers at Nationals Park, was the Nats' starting center fielder in all 4 games, 0-for-11 with a walk and 4 strikeouts. I mean, he looked lost at the plate in that series. He bounces back, at least on Monday night, with 2 full-count doubles. Also on Monday night, Yan Gomes was back. Don't take that for granted with all the injuries the Nats are dealing with right now. So Gomes did not play in that 5-1 loss to the Dodgers at Nats Park on Sunday due to his arm being sore. He got hit by a 3-0 pitch from Dodgers reliever Joe Kelly to load the bases with 2 outs in the bottom of the 6th in the Nats' 5-3 loss to the Dodgers at Nats Park on Saturday night. When Gomes did not play on Sunday, you said to yourself, oh my gosh, I mean, here we go now with Yan Gomes being injured, in addition to Trey Turner, in addition to all these guys on the Nats' 10-day injured list. But luckily, Yan Gomes is back out there on Monday night. Didn't do much, 0-for-4 with a walk and a couple of strikeouts. But just to have him out there was a win for the Nationals. When it came to the Nats' pitching on Monday night, what a job by the bullpen. We'll get to why so much was needed from the bullpen in a few minutes, but the bullpen delivered. five Nats relievers in this 7-5 win at the Padres on Monday night, combined for 5 2/3 scoreless innings. Now, that's an official line. I do have to say, Kyle MacGowan, who officially tossed 1 2/3 scoreless innings, did allow an inherited runner to score. Padres 2-run fourth, MacGowan allowing the inherited runner to score on a 2-out RBI double by Will Myers on a 1-2 pitch. MacGowan also then issued a 2-out 5-pitch walk of Trent Grisham. But otherwise, the bullpen was superb on Monday night. Wander Suero, a perfect bottom of the sixth with 2 strikeouts. Sam Clay, a perfect bottom of the seventh. Austin Voth, a perfect bottom of the eighth that featured him striking out Fernando Tatis Jr. on just 3 pitches, all swinging strikes for the third out. I mentioned my man Sheiky Baby in the opening segment. Austin Voth made the great Tatis look humble in that plate appearance in the bottom of the eighth, late night on Monday night.
Make him humble!
Yes, Sheiky Baby. Austin Voth put Fernando Tatis Jr. in the camel clutch and made Tatis humble on Monday night.
Make him humble!
Exactly. Thank you, Sheiky Baby. And then Brad Hand, he came into the game and tossed a perfect bottom of the ninth, despite facing the Padres' numbers 3-5 batters in Jake Cronenworth, Manny Machado, and Will Myers, who Hand struck out on 4 pitches. Great to see this from the Nats bullpen off, truthfully, it having been really bad over the course of the 4-game sweep to the Dodgers at Nationals Park. You go back to the 10-5 loss to the Dodgers on Friday night. The bullpen, a complete disaster in that game. Sam Clay, Austin Voth, and Kyle Lobstein combined to allow 9 runs in the top of the seventh. Yes, you heard that right. Clay, Voth, and Lobstein, top of the seventh on Friday night. 9 runs allowed combined. The 5-1 loss to the Dodgers on Sunday, 3 Nats relievers in that game combined to allow 2 runs in 2 1/3 innings, including 2 guys who looked great on Monday night, and even that doesn't tell the whole story. So Brad Hand on Sunday officially tossed 1 1/3 scoreless innings, but he allowed a crucial inherited runner to score. And Wander Suero on Sunday was a complete mess in the top of the ninth, during which he allowed 2 runs and got just 1 out. He faced 5 batters and got just 1 out. But the bullpen, tremendous for the Nats on Monday night. And the bullpen needed to be tremendous because the Nats starting pitcher in the 7-5 win of the Padres on Monday night was John Lester. And John Lester was bad for a third consecutive start. Lester, 5 runs, 2 earned in 3 1/3 innings. He gave up 6 hits, a homer, 2 doubles, and 3 singles. He issued 4 walks, one of which was intentional. He issued a hit by pitch. He had just 2 strikeouts, which came against the Padres' first 2 batters in the bottom of the first. You talk about being misled. You talk about false advertising. Lester begins his outing with back-to-back strikeouts. You say, hey, Johnny Lester, old Johnny boy, looking good. No, that was not the case over the course of the rest of his outing. How about this? He threw 83 pitches on Monday night, 48 strikes versus 35 balls. Way too few strikes, way too many balls. Lester did have a 1-out RBI single in the Nats' 4-run second. So I guess Davey Martinez deploying Lester as a pinch hitter multiple times against the Dodgers now has been justified. More on that coming up in just a few moments. But yeah, man, Lester, at least as a pitcher on Monday night, was not good. He tossed a scoreless bottom of the first despite loading the bases with 2 outs as he gave up a 2-out single followed by back-to-back 2-out walks. Then the problems truly began. Lester gave up 3 unearned runs in the bottom of the third, all with 2 outs. The issue started with a fielding error by third baseman Starling Castro, who botched a backhanded stab of a Jake Cronenworth grounder. And then Lester unraveled as he in succession gave up a 2-out 5-pitch walk to Manny Machado, a 2-out single to Will Myers, a 2-out full count bases loaded hit by pitch to Trent Grisham, despite him having been down in the count at 1.12, a 2-out 2-run double to Ha Sung Kim. Lester allowed 2 more runs in the bottom of the fourth on a 1-out solo homer by Fernando Tatis Jr., despite him having been down in the count at 1.12, and a 1-out double by Jake Cronenworth, who scored on the 2-out RBI double by Will Myers on the 1-2 pitch from reliever Kyle MacGowan. So here's where we are now with John Lester this season. He has made 13 starts. He has an ERA of 5.34. He has a whip of 1.63. John Lester, over his last 3 starts, has allowed 17 runs, 14 earned, in 10 2/3 innings. Here's the truth. If Steven Strasburg and Eric Fetty were healthy and not on the 10-day injured list, there would be no justification for John Lester still being in the Nationals rotation. Lester is lucky that both Strasburg and Fetty are out right now, because there's no way that you could justify having Lester in the rotation over my guy, Paolo Espino. But with Lester right now, you just feel like you have no shot when he takes the mound. The 15-6 win over the Tampa Bay Rays at Nationals Park last Wednesday. Lester in that game, 5 runs in 5 innings. The 11-2 loss at the Miami Marlins on June 25th. Lester in that game, 7 runs in 2 1/3 innings. He was not good over the previous 2 seasons with the Chicago Cubs, 2019 and 2020. He has been quantifiably worse so far this year. And for a while, things were going okay. He had an ERA for the season under 4 not that long ago. But even that felt like a house of cards. Even that felt like smoke and mirrors, because the whip was still sky high. And now things have completely fallen apart for John Lester. And the sort of phony success that he was having, and I say phony, I mean, you understand what I'm saying. He's putting a lot of guys on base. He was doing the veteran thing of not allowing those guys to score, but it's very hard to sustain that over the course of a season. And sure enough, Lester is not sustaining that. And the chickens have come home to roost when it comes to John Lester's ERA on the season. Again, 5.34 over 13 starts. But the Nats did win on Monday night, and the Nats needed this win off what happened against the Los Angeles Dodgers in that 4-game series at Nationals Park. A 4-game sweep. You had the 6-2 rain-shortened 5-inning loss on Thursday night, a 10-5 loss on Friday night, a 5-3 loss on Saturday night, and a 5-1 loss on Sunday. This was a total dud of a series. There was so much about this series that was so promising. The series ended up being a debacle. The Nats got swept in 4 games, during which the Nats were outscored 26-11, and the Nats concluded an 0-7 season against the Dodgers. I mean, how about just the Saturday night game on Fox? The official attendance for the game, a sellout, 42,064. The first sellout at Nationals Park since Game 5 of the 2019 World Series. But the game ended up being not just a loss for the Nats, but the game ended up including a rain delay of 1 hour 44 minutes, resulting in the post-game fireworks show being canceled. Nothing went the Nats' way over the course of this 4-game series against the Dodgers, and I didn't even mention all the injury stuff that we covered in the early portion of this segment. But here's what I really want to hone in on with this 4-game sweep to the Dodgers. The Nats' infield was a disheveled mess due to the injury situation. This really became absurd. You had shortstop Trey Turner out due to his jammed left middle finger. You had infielder Jordy Mercer out due to his strained right quadriceps. The Nats on Saturday put their backup catcher Alex Avila on the 10-day injured list, retroactive to July 2nd, with bilateral calf strains. Did he suffer the bilateral calf strains due to having to play second base? Because yes, in that aforementioned 6-2 rain-shortened 5-inning loss to the Dodgers on Thursday night, the Nats, because of Turner and Mercer being unavailable, and also because of a number of minor league infielders being injured, talking about Luis Garcia, Adrian Sanchez, and Carter Kieboom, actually had Avila, the backup catcher, as the starting second baseman. He had never played second base in his major league career, which started in 2009, and sure enough, that's the last time we saw Alex Avila play, as he has suffered these bilateral calf strains. Now, do we know specifically that Alex Avila suffered the bilateral calf strains due to playing second base? No, but just thinking about things logically, that's the last game in which Avila played, and now he's injured, and he's on the 10-day IL. So, you know, you think about like the domino effect here of injuries leading to Avila having to play second base. Avila gets hurt, which ends up being, right, another injury. The Nats in this series against the Dodgers ended up starting 3 different players at shortstop over the first 3 games of the series. Starling Castro was the Nats starting shortstop in Game 1. Humberto Arteaga was the Nats starting shortstop in Game 2. And Alcides Escobar was the Nats starting shortstop in Game 3. The Nats selected the contract of this guy, Arteaga, from AAA Rochester. The Nats signed Arteaga to a minor league contract this past February 4th. This is his age 27 season. His only major league experience had been 41 games with the Kansas City Royals in 2019. Arteaga was the Nats starting shortstop and number 8 batter and that 10-5 loss to the Dodgers at Nationals Park on Friday night. 0-3 with an RBI. He had a 1-out RBI sac fly in the Nats 3-run second. And then the next day, Saturday, the Nats designated Arteaga for assignment. So his tenure with the Nats at the major league level lasted for exactly one game. The Nats then made that trade for Escobar, and like we said, he's been quite good over these last few games. But I want to make these points, okay? Because this was a mess, what the Nats were dealing with their infield. So the mess was a function of two things. The first thing was, yes, just some terrible injury luck, okay? I mean, the Nats having Trey Turner, Jordy Mercer, and Alex Avila all getting hurt over the course of 2 days, plus the minor leaguers, Luis Garcia, Adrian Sanchez, and Carter Kieboom all being hurt, really was absurd, okay? I mean, this was a dark cloud hovering above you and just a lot of things going poorly in a short period of time. But also in play in all of this is a poorly constructed Nationals roster. That you had to turn to Alex Avila to play second base in game one of that series against the Dodgers was not right. And that was a screaming indictment of the Nats' lack of depth and also lack of, wait for it, position flex.
Position flex.
Yes, Ron Rivera's favorite thing, position flex. It's not just a thing in football. It's also very much a thing in baseball. And the Nationals this season have a major lack of position flex.
Position flex.
Yes, Ron. You know, you look at some of the really good teams in Major League Baseball, the Dodgers, the Tampa Bay Rays. Those teams have deep rosters filled with players who can play multiple positions. The Nats roster is not filled with such players. The Nats roster includes guys like Ryan Zimmerman and Josh Bell, who only play first base. That's it. Those guys are the opposite of position flex guys. The Dodgers roster includes the Virginia product, Chris Taylor. Wahoo wah. Chris Taylor just this season has played center field, second base, left field, shortstop, third base, and right field. That, my friends, is position flex. I promise you, Ron Rivera at night has dreams about Chris Taylor.
Position flex.
Yeah, I mentioned that the Nats getting swept in this series concluded an 0-7 season for them against the Dodgers. There are reasons for that, including the roster construction for each team. And then, yes, how about what happened in both games 2 and 3? John Lester pinch hitting. Because Alex Avila was unavailable, Davey Martinez used John Lester, a fading starting pitcher, as a pinch hitter for reliever Kyle Lobstein in that 10-5 loss to the Dodgers at Nationals Park on Friday night. Two outs, bases empty, bottom of the seventh. Lester comes up as a pinch hitter, strikes out on 5 pitches. This is actually a second consecutive Friday night on which Davey used a starting pitcher as a pinch hitter, because Davey, in the 11-2 loss at the Miami Marlins on June 25th, had Joe Ross as a pinch hitter for reliever Justin Miller. Ross in that game struck out on 3 pitches. And then on Saturday night, the 5-3 loss to the Dodgers at Nationals Park, Davey did it again. He used John Lester as a pinch hitter in that game. Used Lester as a pinch hitter for reliever Ryan Harper with 2 outs and the bases empty in the bottom of the 5th. And what happened? Lester again struck out on 5 pitches. This was an embarrassment. This was amateur hour. That Davey's bench was so shallow and so lacking in options that he had to use a starting pitcher, John Lester, as a pinch hitter in back-to-back games and against the Dodgers. See, the juxtaposition in this series was so striking. The ultra-deep Dodgers against the ultra-shallow Nationals. And yes, the Nationals have been torn up by injuries recently, no doubt. But it's not just the injuries that led to something like John Lester having to pinch it. Don't be a fanboy and just write that off to, well, the Nats are really banged up. No, there's more to it than that. This is not a well-constructed Nationals roster. This is a Nationals organization that is lacking in major league-ready options at the minor league level. I mean, geez, in the minors, you don't have anyone you can call up to help you out here. The Nats need to get deeper. The Nats need, yes, more position flex. Well, John Grandland of Real Broker knows about commission flex. He also knows, though, how to sell your home. And so if you need to sell your home and aren't sure to whom to turn, if you've been trying to sell your home and you're not satisfied with how things are going, if you're just even thinking about selling your home, contact my guy, John Grandland, a.k.a. John G., and ask him about what I keep telling you about, commission flex. We just talked about it. The Nats very much lack position flex. John Grandland in no way lacks commission flex.
Position flex.
Yes, Ron, you have position flex. John Granlin, a.k.a. John G., has commission flex. You see, not every house requires the same amount of work or money spent marketing, so why should you pay the same commission? If your house is going to sell in 5 minutes, you shouldn't have to pay the same commission as someone whose home is going to take a while to sell and require far more work from the real estate agent. This flat fee, no matter what stuff, is ridiculous. Let John Granlin put a marketing plan together for you that will maximize your home's value and help you keep more of your hard-earned equity in your pocket. John Granlin has a menu of commission packages that you can choose from, including selling your home for free. Yes, you heard that right. For free, some conditions apply. But this is what Commission Flex is all about. Interviewing John Granlin is an absolute no-brainer. He can come by your house, give you a step-by-step plan on what to do to get top dollar, and maybe even more importantly, what not to do so you don't spend needlessly and there is never any obligation to list or sell. Do yourself a favor, call John Granlin. He's a great guy, big Washington football team fan, big Nationals fan, but most importantly, he is a master of the DMV when it comes to selling homes. Call John Granlin now. It's 703-537-6747. That's 703-537-6747. Make sure you tell them that Al Galdi sent you, and make sure you say, hey, I heard about this commission flex on the Al Galdi podcast. What can you tell me about that? What can you do for me as I try to sell my home? You can also visit John Granlin online at johngsellsforfree.com. That's johngsellsforfree.com. John Granlin, nobody will do a better job of selling your home. And yes, while the Nats may lack in position flex, John Granlin does not lack in commission flex.
Position flex.
Exactly, Ron. Just like position flex. Also regarding the Nats, I do want to say this. Max Scherzer not being named to the 2021 National League All-Star team, at least not yet, is absurd. So we on Sunday evening had the official announcement of the 2021 National and American League All-Star teams for the All-Star game, which will take place at Coors Field in Denver on Tuesday night, July 13th, making the NL All-Star team were three Nats, Kyle Schwarber, Juan Soto, and Trey Turner. Great news for them. All three guys are having good to great seasons, and while, say, Soto isn't hitting for nearly as much power as you want, he still overall is having a good season, and of course, he's one of the great, bright, young stars of Major League Baseball. But not among the Nats named to this initial 2021 NL All-Star team, shockingly, was Max Scherzer. Now, of course, this can change as guys drop out. You would think that Max is the first pitcher who will be used as a replacement on the roster, or at the very least among the first pitchers who will be called upon to serve as replacements. But Max Scherzer shouldn't have to be a replacement. Max Scherzer should already be on the NL All-Star team. Max Scherzer, through games on Sunday, had the following rankings among qualified pitchers in the National League. Fifth in ERA at 2.10. Fourth in WHIP at 0.848. Third in strikeouts per nine innings at 12.117. Fifth in RA9 WAR, which is a version of WAR, wins above replacement, that deals with how many innings you throw and how many runs you give up. Max's RA9 WAR through games on Sunday, 3.9. Again, fifth among all qualified National League pitchers. Now, starting pitchers on the NL All-Star team over Max include Germán Márquez of the Colorado Rockies. Max blows away Márquez in each of the stats that I just took you through. But as you likely know, one of the rules for Major League Baseball's All-Star game is that every Major League team must have at least one All-Star. That's fine, but this is why a player's number of All-Star selections should never be used as a measure of greatness. Because so often, deserving guys are not selected as All-Stars, and guys who aren't that deserving get selected as All-Stars. Max Scherzer is having maybe the best season of his career. If his ERA and WHIP hold up, each one will be the best he's ever had in a season. And yet he's not an All-Star.
Cuckoo! Cuckoo!
I know! It makes no sense, And yet that is the case. Personally, I don't get that worked up about who is and who isn't an all-star, even though I'm getting worked up right now. But I just wanted to highlight this to point out the ridiculousness that can be the all-star selections. And what has happened with Max Scherzer is wrong. He is a deserving all-star. I hope he ends up being one. I tend to think that he will be one, but that's not the point. We shouldn't even have to have this conversation. Game 2 for the Nats at the Padres Tuesday night at 10:10. We do not know who the Nats starting pitcher will be. David Martinez, during his post-game press conference late night on Monday night, said that he was going to have some conversations with his relievers to see who will be available for Game 2 on Tuesday night. Davey also indicated that there will be some roster moves.
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy. Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
So on Friday's installment of the podcast, episode 95, I went in depth on the mega news of last Thursday, the outcome of the Beth Wilkinson investigation into the Washington football team's sexual harassment scandal, or as the statement from the NFL said, quote, the outcome of the workplace review of the Washington football team, end quote. Yes, the workplace. And my basic point was that the outcome was another win for Dan Snyder. Somehow, despite all of the chaos of the last 12 months with the sexual harassment scandal, the ownership turmoil, the name change, Dan Snyder, the Danny, keeps winning. I mean, you consider the calendar year of 2021. January, the Washington football team wins the NFC East. March, the NFL announces the signing of new long-term national television contracts that work out to a reported $10.27 billion per year, more than double what the NFL has been making under its previous national television deals. So Dan's going to be getting more than twice the national TV money as compared to what he's currently getting. April, Dan officially buys out his disgruntled minority partners, Dwight Shaw, Robert Rothman, and Fred Smith, at the reported discounted price of $875 million and with a reported $450 million debt waiver for which the NFL's finance committee made a special exemption. Last Tuesday, Dan names his wife, Tanya Snyder, as co-CEO. And last Thursday, Dan emerges from the Beth Wilkinson investigation having to pay a token $10 million fine and with no official suspension. Dan keeps winning. He is, as I said on Friday, Leslie Chow in the movie The Hangover, continually getting over on Phil and Stu, like when Mr. Chow is powering up his window and says, toodaloo, mother bleepers.
Toodaloo, motherfucker.
Hey, you
yes, toodaloo, mother bleepers. That's Dan right now. Now, I mentioned Dan emerging from the Beth Wilkinson investigation, having to pay a token $10 million fine and with no official suspension. Specific to there being no official suspension for Dan, we of course have the oh-so-interesting phrasing of what's happening. Lengthy statement put out by The Danny on Thursday announced two things. A, Tanya Snyder, who, right, was just named co-CEO last Tuesday, what a coincidence, is assuming responsibilities of CEO and overseeing all day-to-day team operations and representation of the club on all league activities. B, Dan will be concentrating his time, quote, during the next several months on developing a new stadium plan and other matters, end quote. This reads like an unofficial suspension, right? Well, Dan's lawyer has struck back at that notion. Jordan Sieve, who has actually served as Meek Mill's attorney. And as we all know, there are many similarities between Meek Mill and Dan Snyder. Jordan Sieve, he told ESPN NFL insider Adam Schefter on Friday, quote, "Any suggestion that Commissioner Goodell must approve Dan Snyder's return to daily control is false. Dan was not suspended, so by definition, he does not need to be reinstated to any position," end quote. Interesting that Dan's attorney saw fit to put this out there publicly. And I have to laugh at all this because one of two things quite clearly is the case here. Either Dan Snyder has been suspended and Sieve is lying, which I know is hard to believe that a lawyer would lie, or Dan hasn't been suspended and the team put out that statement without considering the obvious possibility of people interpreting the statement as Dan having been suspended. Either way, not good. Either the lawyer is lying, or the team was so clueless when the statement got put out that the team never even considered the obvious consideration of people interpreting the statement as Dan having been suspended. But we also have had something else pop up over the last few days, and this something else is yet another win for Dan Snyder. All this guy keeps doing is winning this year. It's really amazing. So Mike Florio of Pro Football Talk last Thursday night reported that the NFL has banned former Washington limited partner Dwight Schar from ever owning any portion of any NFL team again. This item has not gotten a lot of attention, but this is certainly notable. So Dwight Schar was the Washington minority owner who Dan believed was a financial backer of the alleged smear campaign against Dan last summer. This gets complicated. I'm going to try to keep this simple. Last summer, in the lead up to the first article by the Washington Post on the sexual harassment scandal, we had all of those wild rumors about what was going to be in the article circulating on the internet. Among the rumors, right? Dan Snyder had abused drugs and alcohol. Dan Snyder had bribed some NFL officials, some of whom had made $2 million off Dan, and Dan wasn't the only NFL owner who had paid league officials. Jay Gruden did drugs and participated in sex parties. Washington pimped out cheerleaders to sweetholders. The late convicted sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein was somehow involved in all of this. Remember how insane the rumors got in the lead up to that first Washington Post article on the sexual harassment scandal? Well, none of these things has ever come close to being proven to being true. The only wild rumor that was out there that has been confirmed by someone is the rumor that Jay Gruden and Capri Bibbs slept with the same Washington receptionist, prompting Jay to bench Bibbs in favor of Byron Marshall, whose missed block in a loss to the Houston Texans at FedEx Field in November 2018 led to, yes, Alex Smith's gruesomely injured right leg. Capri has confirmed that he and Jay slept with the same Washington employee. Now, that doesn't mean that that's true. We've never heard Jay's side of the story, but at least we have had some confirmation of this rumor. Otherwise, all of these other things appear, and I stress that word, appear to have been fake news. Well, Dan, in a lawsuit filed on August 7, 2020, accused an online media company of accepting payment in exchange for publishing the defamatory rumors. Dan said that a news site, Media Entertainment Arts Worldwide, which has a parent company based in India, published stories that the site knew were false and that were designed to malign Dan. Dan was seeking $10 million in damages in the lawsuit. Then came a filing in federal district court on August 10th, 2020. Dan in that filing charged that a disgruntled former employee helped to wage a campaign against him that resulted in the defamatory articles. Dan said that Mary Ellen Blair, who worked for Washington from 2013 to 2017 as an executive assistant in the front office, took money to help spread damaging information about Dan. And then there was this. Dan's filing also said that Blair had a financial benefactor who had helped with her rent. Now, she had lived in what the filing described as a luxury apartment building owned by Comstock. Guess who was on the board of directors at Comstock and in fact served as the senior vice president for marketing at Comstock Holding Companies? The daughter of Dwight Schar, Tracy Shore. And according to the New York Times, Comstock's board included two other people who had worked for a company called Red Zone Capital, which was co-owned by Snyder and Shore. So the implication clearly was that Dwight Shore helped to fund the smear campaign. Is that true? Who knows? But that's what Dan was implying. This is where the feud between Dan and the now former minority partners really got ugly. Well, the NFL now has sided with Dan even more, as in addition to allowing him to buy out the minority partners at the reported discount price of $875 million and with a reported $450 million debt waiver for which the NFL's finance committee made a special exemption, the league now has permanently banned Dan's archenemy, Dwight Shore, from ever owning any portion of any NFL team again. Wrote Florio, quote, "Along the way, allegations and litigation and accusations emerged with clear acrimony between Snyder and Shore. The NFL frowned upon the filing of a lawsuit by the limited partners over Snyder's effort to selectively apply his right of first refusal after a buyer for the minority interest was found, and it was believed that the league eventually would take against one or more of the limited partners. Per one source, only Shore faces the ban. Smith and Ruffman were not affected," end quote. Indeed, it sure seems like things between Dan Snyder and Dwight Shore got ultra personal. Remember what we talked about regarding the divorce between the Washington football team and Inova? A big financial backer of Inova has been Dwight Shore. Part of the Inova health system is the Inova Shore Cancer Institute, named after, yes, Dwight Shore. May 2015, we learned that Dwight Shore and his wife Martha donated $50 million to build what became the Inova Shore Cancer Institute. And now the NFL very clearly, again, has sided with Danny when it comes to this feud with Shore and the minority owners. Incredibly, amazingly, another win for Donny Boy in all of this. Toodaloo, mother bleepers. That's what Dan is saying to Dwight Shore, Robert Rothman, and Fred Smith.
Toodaloo, motherfucker.
Hey,
Yes, exactly. You can always email me, thealgaldipodcast@yahoo.com. Email from Roy O'Grady. This joke of an investigation is one time he is definitely winning off the field. Yes, exactly. As Bruce Allen famously said,
we're winning off the field.
No, there's no debating this. Donny Boy is winning off the field. All right, so last Thursday, July 1st, was a crazy day regarding the Washington football team, as that was the day on which we got the outcome of the Beth Wilkinson investigation into Washington's workplace. But also last Thursday was the publishing of Pro Football Focus's annual summer rankings of all 32 NFL rosters. And guess which team made a massive leap? Yes, the Washington football team. 31st in 2020, 12th in 2021. Very pleased to welcome to the Al Galdi podcast right now the author of PFF's rankings of all 32 NFL rosters, Ben Lindsay, analyst for Pro Football Focus. Ben, it's great to talk to you. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate you coming on. Before we get into the big jump for the Washington football team from last year to this year, what you do in ranking all 32 NFL teams' rosters isn't easy. How do you go about doing it? What's your process?
Yeah, it's not easy. Just sort of weighting how much you value roster overall, how much you value those sort of high-end positions like quarterback. So what I did for these rankings was took some of our unit rankings. We went through and ranked each team's quarterback, running back room, receiving core, and those sorts of things, and then sort of weighted it based on how we value each of those positions, using some of our wins above replacement metrics and things like that, and sort of found an average for each team, and then made some manual adjustments to that.
So the jump for the Washington football team in your roster rankings from 31st in 2020 to 12th in 2021, is that the biggest jump of a team from one year to the next in your time doing these rankings?
Yeah, it's up there. It's a pretty big one. And I think they exceeded expectations last year, even though things went south with Dwayne Haskins, obviously. I think some of their young guys took a step forward. And then I'm a big fan of a lot of what they did this offseason. Some of the guys they brought in, what they did in the draft at some spots. So they're definitely heading in the right direction.
I've had one of your colleagues, Sam Monson, on the podcast multiple times. He's a big fan of Washington having signed Ryan Fitzpatrick this offseason, as I'm sure you know. I'm a fan of that as well. To what extent, in your opinion, is Fitzpatrick an upgrade for Washington at quarterback?
The big thing with Fitzpatrick is he's just going to add a different element to their passing attack. Last year, without Smith specifically, there just wasn't anything down the field. He had the lowest percentage of his throws past the first down marker of any quarterback in the NFL. And when you have the speed that Washington does at wide receiver, you want to be attacking defenses downfield. And Fitzpatrick's certainly not afraid to do that. His play has been up and down throughout his career, but these last couple years in a part-time role, sort of spot starts, splitting time with other quarterbacks, have been the best years of his career. So, I mean, obviously we have to see if he can continue that going into the season as a starter and sort of having that role full-time. But I do think it's an upgrade, and it should add some more excitement to that offense.
Yeah, and it's an offense that has lacked excitement for way too long. What do you think about Washington's skill position players?
Yeah, I think it's intriguing. One of the things that I think is sort of interesting with the guys they have now is there's a lot of sort of running, receiving versatility with Antonio Gibson, with J.D. McKissic, with Curtis Samuel. McKissic ran more routes lined up at wide receiver than any running back in the NFL last year. Antonio Gibson obviously played wide receiver at Memphis. Curtis Samuel's been used in the backfield. So I think there's some interesting things they can do on offense with those guys. And McLaurin should have a little bit more help this year with Samuel, with De'Ami Brown, with Adam Humphries, if he can stay on the field, than he has in the past.
It's interesting with Washington at running back because the team's top two running backs are converted receivers, Antonio Gibson and J.D. McKissic. Given where we are in the NFL with the importance of passing the football and the continued diminishing of the importance of pure running backs, do you think that this is the template for NFL teams at running back moving forward, converting receivers to running backs, or at the very least, having running backs who are just as adept at catching the football as those backs are at running with the football?
Yeah, I think so. With passing, you're getting up there for some teams, you're passing on 65, 70% of downs. So to have a guy who isn't really a threat in the backfield, you have to be a Derrick Henry, you have to be a Nick Chubb, you have to be so dominant running the ball that it doesn't really matter. But in most cases, being able to go out there and provide value as a receiver is sort of a prerequisite at the position.
We're talking Washington football team with Ben Lindsay, analyst for Pro Football Focus. He's ranked Washington as having the 12th best roster in the NFL. You mentioned your position group rankings. You, in June, ranked Washington as having the second best defensive line in the NFL. The line has been built primarily on Washington spending a bunch of first-round picks on defensive linemen. What do you make of that as a strategy for building up a unit, just spending a bunch of first-round picks on that unit?
Yeah, I don't think it's a terrible strategy. The defensive line is a position where if you're elite, you're going to be making a lot of money. So getting guys who are already playing at a high level, like Jonathan Allen, Montez Sweat, Chase Young, Deron Payne, like those guys have and did last year, it's really valuable when you have those guys on rookie contracts. Now, of course, it's going to come back and they're going to have to start paying some of those guys here soon. But for right now, it gives them some flexibility in building their roster.
I know that you're a big fan of the season that Jonathan Allen had in 2020. His sack total wasn't great, but as we know by now, sacks aren't everything. The analytics really do reveal Allen to have had a very good 2020 season. What sticks out to you?
Yeah, he just has so many different ways that he wins as a pass rusher. He can win with power. He has one of the better bull rushes in the league. That cross chop hump move that he uses, it has been really effective. So he had a top 10 pass rush grade and pass rush win rate for us. So even though he only had two sacks, he was one of the better interior rushers in the NFL. And sort of the attention that draws gives more one-on-one opportunities to the other talented guys on that defensive line.
When you're evaluating someone as a pass rusher, what is the best number to look at? I know that no one stat is perfect, but given what we now know about sacks, what is the best thing to look at in terms of assessing, okay, is this guy or isn't this guy a quality pass rusher?
Yeah, you want to look, anytime you want to look at a combination of things, just one number is not going to do the best job. But I think pass rush grade, it probably does the best for us, just because it sort of incorporates wins and losses, even when they don't result in pressures. So if a guy beats a first blocker and gets picked up with a double team, and also the quality of the wins, how quickly guys are beating those blocks, how impressive the pressure or sack was. So I would go with that one.
Do you even look at sacks, or do you essentially disregard sacks at this point?
Sacks are tricky because they are valuable. Obviously, the sacks kill drives. So ideally, you want those pressures ending up in sacks. But it's one of those things where it's not super stable from year to year. And the exception of a few cases, guys like Brandon Graham have struggled throughout his career to turn pressures into sacks. Same with Jadeveon Clowney. So there are a few guys who are exceptions. But generally, if you're getting pressure at a high rate, the sacks are going to come. And if you have high sack seasons without a ton of pressures, that's going to balance itself out in the long run.
You in June ranked Washington as having the 11th best secondary in the NFL. What are your impressions of Washington's secondary?
Yeah, I think bringing in William Jackson is an upgrade over Ronald Darby. Even though Darby played well last year, I think he gives them a little bit more flexibility to play man coverage. Kendall Fuller played well. It'll be interesting to see what they do at safety, because Cameron Curl really exceeded expectations the last season. But it's not a natural fit putting both him and Landon Collins out there on the field together. So it'll be interesting to see what they do there. But I think overall, it's a pretty strong unit.
You identified Washington's offensive line as being a potential problem. What concerns you with the O-line?
It's really just the moving pieces. Cornelius Lucas played well last year, but he might be moving to right tackle now with Charles Leno. At left guard, you got a career year from Wes Schweitzer, but can he continue that? Does Eric Flowers push him for that job? And then at right tackle, you might be looking at Sam Cosmi there, and it's tough relying on rookies, particularly rookie offensive linemen, just based on they usually need a year or two to develop in the NFL, unless you're Tristan Wirfs or one of these guys who's had success early. But I just think there's a little bit of turnover there that could be a potential issue.
So with the rest of the NFC East, you have the Dallas Cowboys as having the 8th best roster in the NFL, New York Giants the 19th best roster, and the Philadelphia Eagles the 29th best roster in the NFL. Which of the other three NFC East teams was the toughest to evaluate for you?
I think Dallas is tough. A lot of people thought 8th was too high for Dallas, and there is a case for that based on their defense. Their defense still has a lot of work to do. But their offense, if they can stay healthy, which they weren't last year, is just so talented. It has the potential to be one of the best offenses in the NFL. I think Dak Prescott was really impressive before he went down with an injury. They should get Tyron Smith, Lyle Collins back. They have one of the best receiving corps in the NFL. So I think just balancing out how strong their offense is and some of the concerns they have on defense, particularly their interior defensive line, some of the guys in their secondary, they were tough to place.
I want to get your take on some general principles when it comes to team building. When you're trying to build a truly strong roster in the NFL, is it better to have high-end players at certain positions or to be at least decent everywhere, like the classic quality versus quantity debate? Which do you think matters more in terms of team building in the NFL?
I think for a lot of positions, you're seeing that it's quantity. Obviously, if you have a Jalen Ramsey, Aaron Donald, those guys can really help turn around the defense sort of by themselves. But in the secondary especially, if you have a weak link, teams are going to find it and they're going to attack it. The same thing on the offensive line. Teams are going to line up their best pass rusher over your weak link and attack it. And there's only so much you can do, even if you have elite players alongside them in those position groups. So in general, sort of eliminating weaknesses is probably more important than having the super high-end talent.
When it comes to the secondary versus the defensive front, I know this was a big thing for Pro Football Focus a few years ago of how actually pass coverage matters more than pass rush. We talked about Washington's defensive line. Washington has spent a lot of first-round picks on that D-line. But is it in fact the case that if you're going to try to load up at a specific position group on defense, you should be doing it with the secondary because of the way that the NFL is right now?
It's one of those things where the defensive line, it's easier. You can feel more confident that those guys are going to be elite year in and year out. The play in the secondary we've seen is a little bit more volatile. It depends on scheme. Cornerbacks can have up and down years. Whereas if you have an elite pass rusher, a Khalil Mack, a Myles Garrett, a TJ Watt, a Chase Young, it looks like those guys are going to play at a high level year in and year out. They're also going to cost a little bit more. So I think in an ideal world, you find some balance. The secondary play we found has been a little bit more valuable, but it's a little bit harder to rely on.
Yeah, I think that's such a dilemma if you're in charge of football operations for an NFL team, right? Because secondary play may matter more, but it's less stable. It's more unpredictable. So should teams pay big money to defensive backs, knowing that those defensive backs' performances can fluctuate so violently year to year?
Yeah, it's a good point. I think when you're sort of looking at those guys in free agency or guys on your roster already that you're looking at giving extensions who sort of have a breakout right before that comes, I would be wary of paying those guys big multi-year extensions. And at the defensive line, on the other hand, it might not be the worst idea to give those guys the contracts and continue to build up the secondary through the draft.
You referenced Pro Football Focus's version of WAR, wins above replacement, and it's great that PFF has developed a WAR for football. We know that isolating individual performance in football is so difficult, so much harder than doing so is in baseball. What would you say are some of the takeaways of PFF WAR, the lessons you have learned in terms of positional value, especially with the WAR metric that Pro Football Focus has developed?
It's sort of what we were talking about earlier, the value, coming back to the value of the secondary and sort of the perimeter at wide receiver in comparison to playing the trenches. PFF WAR has those high-end wide receivers, high-end defensive backs, a good bit higher than offensive linemen, defensive linemen, and then quarterback. I know everyone knows that quarterback is really important, and if you don't have a quarterback, it's going to be tough to win. But PFF WAR really just highlights how much more valuable those guys are than the other positions on the team. You're looking at a high-end quarterback being worth three wins above replacement, and then guys like Jair Alexander, TJ Watt, they're closer to the one range, even in the most elite off seasons during their career.
Wow. Does that strike you as accurate? Like it is, in fact, that drastic, the difference between quarterback and every other position?
I think so. I think you've seen it on a few teams recently. Denver is one that comes to mind for this upcoming year. I think just from overall roster, they would probably be pushing the top five, but it's hard to see them being super competitive if they don't land in Aaron Rodgers and they roll with whoever wins that competition between Drew Lock and Teddy Bridgewater.
Appreciate the time, Ben. Great work. Continued success at Pro Football Focus.
Anytime. Take care.
All right, my friends, let us talk some Wizards.
The damn Washington Wizards.
Yes, that team. The Wizards head coaching search continues, and we on Monday had some news. ESPN NBA insider Adrian Wojnarowski on Monday tweeted that the Wizards head coaching search has narrowed to several NBA assistant coaches with whom the Wizards would be speaking again in the coming week. These assistants per Woj included Dallas Mavericks assistant coach Jamal Mosley, Milwaukee Bucks assistant coach Darvin Ham, Milwaukee Bucks assistant coach Charles Lee, whose name, as best as I can tell, had not been previously reported regarding the Wizards head coaching vacancy, and Denver Nuggets associate head coach Wes Unseld Jr. So the guy who I want to get the job, Wes Jr., remains in contention. The two Bucks assistants stand out in terms of new names. We just learned of Darvin Ham being in the mix over the weekend, as The Athletic on Saturday reported that the Wizards had recently interviewed Ham for their head coaching vacancy. Darvin Ham, as you may recall, played for the Wizards in the 1997-98 season. He was known for his dunks. The Ham Slam was a thing back in the day. And then this guy, Charles Lee, like I said, his name had not been previously reported regarding the Wizards head coaching vacancy until this Woj report on Monday. What stands out about Charles Lee is that he's a local. He went to Quince Orchard High School in Gaithersburg, Maryland. So here now are all of the reported candidates in the Wizards head coaching search. If I've missed any, let me know. But as best as I can gather, these are all of the names that have come up in the Wizards head coaching search via various reports. Denver Nuggets associate head coach Wes Unseld Jr., Philadelphia 76ers assistant coach Sam Cassell, Los Angeles Clippers assistant coach Chauncey Billups, who the Portland Trailblazers have since hired as their head coach, Boston Celtics assistant coach Scott Morrison, Dallas Mavericks assistant coach Jamal Mosley, Chicago Bulls assistant coach Chris Fleming, Charlotte Hornets assistant coach Ronald Norred, who reportedly is taking a job with the Indiana Pacers, Miami Heat assistant coach Chris Quinn, Phoenix Suns assistant coach Willie Green, Milwaukee Bucks assistant coach Darvin Ham, Milwaukee Bucks assistant coach Charles Lee. 11 candidates. 11! And keep in mind, these are just the names that have been reported. Who knows how many more may be out there? This is about as exhaustive of a head coaching slash managerial search that I can ever remember a DC sports team having. And this is good. I applaud the Wizards for doing this. There's nothing wrong with speaking with a bunch of people, being open-minded to various candidates, hearing what all of these people have to say about your roster, your organization. I think Tommy Shepard casting a wide net is good. And whatever happens with this head coaching search, you can't say that the Wizards didn't talk to a lot of candidates. Have the Wizards spoken with the right candidates? We'll see. Time will tell on the quality of these candidates, but the quantity is undeniable.
The damn Washington Wizards!
Exactly. All right, so we had breaking Maryland basketball news on Monday evening. Aaron Wiggins is staying in the 2021 NBA draft. Second consecutive Monday on which we have bad news for the Terrapins, as Daryl Morsell, the previous Monday, June 28th, announced that he was transferring to Marquette as a graduate transfer. The Terps' top two players last season in terms of minutes per game, points per game, and steals per game were Eric Ayala and Aaron Wiggins. Each guy on April 9th announced that he was declaring for the 2021 NBA draft while maintaining his collegiate eligibility. We last Wednesday got the very good news that Ayala is coming back, as he announced that he would be withdrawing his name from the draft and returning to Maryland for a senior season. But on Monday evening, the news broke that Wiggins is remaining in the draft. And this is bad news if you're a Terps fan. I hope that this proves to be good news for Wiggins. Wiggins, as was the case for Ayala, not showing up much in mock drafts for whatever they're worth. And as I talked about on the podcast last week, recent Maryland basketball history is filled with players leaving early and then getting humbled in NBA drafts. Bruno Fernando, Melo Trimble, Diamond Stone, Robert Carter Jr., Jordan Williams. I just hope that we don't add Wiggins' name to that list. Wiggins, like Ayala, great three-point shooter in his freshman season of 2018-2019. But hasn't come close to being a great three-point shooter since that season. Wiggins, in his 2018-2019 freshman season, shot 41.3% on threes. That's excellent. But he, the next season, shot just 31.7% on threes. And Wiggins, this past season, shot just 35.6% on threes. As for the Terps next season, in the continuing quest for Mark Turgeon to make it to more than one Sweet 16 as Maryland head coach, Maryland still should have a good team. I mean, Ayala, Dante Scott, Hakeem Hart, the transfers, guys like Georgetown transfer Kudus Wahab, the 6'11 Nigerian, Rhode Island transfer and point guard Fats Russell, Utah transfer and shooting guard Ian Martinez. The Terps recruiting class has multiple four-star players, Julian Reese, Ike Cornish, James Graham III. So there's reason for optimism if you're a Terps fan. You just would have had more reason for optimism had Wiggins come back. All right, let's talk some Orioles. The O's had no game on Monday. O's on Tuesday night begin a six-game homestand that will wrap up the Orioles' pre-All-Star break portion of the season. Tuesday night, you have game one of a three-game series against the Toronto Blue Jays at Oriole Park at Camden Yards, 7:05 start. The O's are an American League worst 27-57 with an AL worst run differential of minus 114. The O's over the July 4th weekend swept in three games at the Los Angeles Angels. So much for the Orioles' three-game sweep at the mighty Houston Astros last week. The O's in their three-game sweep at the Angels. 8-7 loss on Friday night. 4-1 loss on Saturday night. 6-5 loss on Sunday. And without question, what stood out more than anything from this series was the extent to which maybe the most exciting player in baseball right now, Shohei Ohtani, put on a show. He can pitch, he can hit, and he tortured the O's in this series. Ohtani was the Angels' starting DH and number two batter in all three games in the series. He went 3-for-10 with three homers and four walks, two of which were intentional, and he had a stolen base. Ohtani in the Orioles' 6-5 loss at the Angels on Sunday smashed a one-out solo homer to center field in the bottom of the third off Orioles starter Thomas Eshelman. The home run went a projected 459 feet per Statcast. 459 feet. I mean, a 400-foot homer is impressive. Ohtani blasted a shot that went 459 in the Orioles' loss at the Angels on Sunday. Ohtani is demolishing pitchers this season, and he demolished the O's over the weekend. As for the Orioles' offense, it did very little in the series, with the exception of Game 1. Game 1 was that Orioles' 8-7 loss on Friday night. O's did do some good things offensively, especially Trey Mancini and Austin Hayes. Mancini was the Orioles' starting DH and number three batter. He himself had a moonshot, a two-out solo homer to center field in the top of the first, and a two-out single in the Orioles' four-run third. The homer going a projected 451 feet per Statcast. So yeah, Ohtani hit one 459 on Sunday. Mancini actually hit one 451 on Friday night. And then Hayes, as the Orioles starting left fielder and number two batter on Friday night, two out single in the Orioles four run third, two out RBI double in the top of the sixth. But that was about it for the Orioles offense in the series. How about the former Oriole, by the way, Alex Cobb? He and the Orioles 4-1 loss on Saturday night, one run in 7 2/3 innings. Where the heck was that from Cobb when he was with the O's? Anyway, the Orioles starting pitching in this series was brutal. Keegan Aiken in game one, a fifth consecutive bad start. This was that 8-7 loss on Friday night. Four runs in three innings. Aiken gave up seven hits, which were two homers, a double, and four singles. He issued a walk, did have three strikeouts, did throw 43 strikes versus 21 balls on 64 pitches. But still, Aiken is getting shellacked. Start in and start out. His ERA this season now is 7.46. Jorge Lopez in game two, ripped again. 4-1 loss on Saturday night. Lopez, 4 runs, 4 2/3 innings. He gave up seven hits, two doubles, and five singles. Issued four walks, though one of them was an intentional walk of Shohei Ohtani. Lopez had three strikeouts. He now has an ERA of 6.02 over 17 starts this season. And then Thomas Eshelman in Game 3 struggled for a third time in four starts this season. Eshelman in that 6-5 loss on Sunday, 4 runs in 4 innings. He now has an ERA of 7.16 over four starts this season. The O's on June 18th selected Eshelman's contract from AAA Norfolk. Eshelman was taken by the Houston Astros in the second round of the 2015 MLB draft. So Eshelman is a Mike Elias guy, right? Elias came to the O's from the Astros. The Astros took Eshelman and the second round in 2015. But so far, not so good for Thomas Eshelman at the Major League level in the 2021 season. A bright spot for the O's over the last few days, Cedric Mullins made the American League All-Star team. We on Sunday evening had the official announcement of the 2021 American and National League All-Star teams for the All-Star game, which will take place at Coors Field in Denver on Tuesday night, July 13th. Making the AL All-Star team was one Oriole, and that one Oriole was Mullins. Now, that's great. Cedric Mullins totally deserves this, but I want to make this clear. Cedric Mullins should be a starter. Like, don't just accept, well, he's a reserve. That's nice. Yes, it is nice, but what would be better and what would be completely justified is Cedric Mullins as a starting outfielder for the American League All-Star team. Cedric Mullins threw games on Sunday, number one by miles among all American League outfielders in wins above replacement, WAR, per Fangraphs, what is known as F-WAR, with the F standing for Fangraphs. Cedric Mullins' F-WAR threw games on Sunday, 3.6, again, number one by miles among all American League outfielders. Number two was the Texas Rangers' Joey Gallo at 2.9. So you had Cedric Mullins number one at 3.6, the next best American League outfielder in terms of F-WAR on the season through Sunday, Joey Gallo at 2.9. You can't convince me that Cedric Mullins does not deserve to be a starting outfielder for the AL All-Star team. It's nice that he makes the team, but he really should be out there starting the game. It really is nuts. We talked about this with Max Scherzer, how it's nuts that he's not on the National League All-Star team. It's nuts that Mullins isn't starting on the American League All-Star team.
Cuckoo! Cuckoo!
Exactly. All right, my friends, that will do it for you and me for now. Keep the feedback coming. You can tweet me at Al Galdi. You can email me, thealgaldipodcast@yahoo.com. Lots more to come on Wednesday's installment of the Al Galdi Podcast. On the Washington football team, I will be joined by a legal expert to really get into the outcome of the Beth Wilkinson investigation and what exactly happened here. Have a great rest of your Tuesday. I'll talk to you on Wednesday.
Make you mumble.